You know what? It's going to be a pretty cold night tonight across Wisconsin, and I'm wondering how comfortable your home is when the temperatures dip. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at how to make your home energy efficient with our guest today, Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
And welcoming in Steve Pipson, a home performance evaluator, home energy score outreach and technical advisor for Focus on Energy. And Steve, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks for inviting me, Larry.
Tell you what, we'll talk about how you can get your home energy score, or maybe get your score raised up a little bit, and why that's a good idea. We'll take any of your other home improvement questions as well as we move along today. So we're going to hopefully increase what you know about saving energy and saving dollars today with our guests. You can call us at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Chad, you do a lot of business in the Madison area, and I know you do a lot of remodeling. And home energy efficiency probably plays a role in many of your, or most of your projects.
That's correct. We always have the conversation with our clients. Do you have comfort concerns? Are there parts of your home that seem drafty? Or, you know, tell us about your home. Let us know, you know. And, and so we might be there to remodel a kitchen or to add an addition, but we're going to be talking about comfort. And we're going to be looking at the whole house, because when you add on to a home, you can inadvertently cause some new problems if you're not thinking about these things. And so we're always trying to be proactive and also to address some issues that maybe the homeowners weren't even thinking about. But, once they're reminded of it, then they want to deal with it.
In your mind, is it more costly to be energy efficient?
Well, that's a great question. The research would suggest that when you're building a home, the added investments in a better shell, a better insulated home, and a home which is properly ventilated, those investments put into the mortgage cost less month after month over 30 years than what you're going to end up saving on your power bill. And so, you know, at the end of the day, since everyone's going to pay their utility bill and they're going to pay their mortgage, if you can reduce your utility bill by more than you've increased your mortgage, you're ahead. And that's generally what we find. And that applies to renovation work typically as well as building a new home.
So. Steve Pipson, I can't tell you how many times Chad and others have said to people who call in, you know, you ought to get a home energy audit. And the Focus on Energy program comes up a lot. And for those who may not be familiar with Focus on Energy, maybe you can start by talking a little bit about what it does.
Sure. So Focus on Energy is a Wisconsin Utilities statewide energy efficiency program. So all the utilities, most of the utilities in the state are participating, and homeowners pay in through their utility company. So then we have incentives available for homeowners to make efficiency improvements. So that could be along the lines of insulation or air sealing or replacing a furnace, all the way down to light bulbs. In the store, you'll see our Focus on Energy logo, and we've discounted that light bulb at the store. So we make it very easy for folks to make efficiency upgrades.
Tell us about the Home Energy Score program.
So Home Energy Score is it's a Department of Energy initiative, and basically it's a miles per gallon for your home. So we're looking at making this very simple for homeowners to understand the relationship between their actual house and the cost of operating that house. So that score is can be completed in less than an hour, costs about $100. Mm-hmm. And someone comes in and takes that information, and then we'll give you a report. And then that report, then they can highlight where the recommendations are, so the first steps to actually improving the house, to making the house more efficient. You know, one of the funny things is that most homeowners believe that their house is already efficient.
And most of the time, Not so much.
And, you know, it's surprising how many times you can walk into a home and point out that there's some things that can be improved to make the house more efficient. So, you know, I think some, you know, it's, and also it can come down to comfort as well. You know?
Yeah. Can any home, I assume any home can get this score? Or?
Any home can get the score. There are some parameters with townhomes or condos or duplexes that we can't get to those, but...
And the process itself, then, you come in, somebody comes in? And...
Correct. It's basically a clipboard inspection, so there's no diagnostic testing of the house.
Hmm.
We just come in for with a list of data points that we've got to collect, information about the square footage, the furnace age, the furnace efficiency, window sizes, ages, and such like that. And all of this goes into the data and algorithms and comes out with a score.
And let's see if I get a... A score of 80, is that a good... What's a good score?
The score is based on a 1 to 10.
Oh, okay.
Keeping it really simple. So it's a 1 to 10. Down at the 1, you're not doing great. Up at the 10, you're doing really great.
And if you... Let's say you get a 3 or a 2 or a 1... What do you do with that? Is that a time then to do blower door testing and everything else? Or
You could go down that road to straight into the blower door testing. If you're going to get incentives from Focus on Energy, you'll need to do that blower door test because we need to know where the air leakage rate is to start with and how much we've improved it at the end. But yes, that would be the next logical step is to go to that assessment or audit, as you called it. For Focus on Energy incentives, you have to do that.
Yeah.
But in our report for the home energy score, you will find the recommendations in there for the next steps.
So lots of things that Chad could take a look at. For example, he's got a homeowner talking to him, and they show him the score. And Chad, you can do something with that then.
That's correct. And this is... You know, it's interesting. Steve and I were talking more about this program prior to the show because it really is quite new. It's only been in the last year in Wisconsin that this program has come here.
Correct.
And the Department of Energy started it in 2012. And I was on a panel at the Better Building Conference back 8 years ago, and I had expressed kind of frustration with our inability to label a home with just a simple score that homeowners would know, because we are all familiar when we go to buy an appliance, you get that sticker that's from, the
Energy Star.
Energy Star, and it lets you know, how does this refrigerator compare to other refrigerators?
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, why don't we do this for a home? Like, everyone that owns a home should know whether or not their home is more efficient than the typical. You know, how efficient is it? How does it rate? Like, can't we come up with a simple thing? And I'm certainly not taking any credit. I mean, I'm one of the, I'm sure, thousands of professionals in the industry who felt this frustration and need.
You know, just thinking about it, if you are going to go to sell your house and you've got a really good score that you could show that the realtor or whatever, that would be a big selling point.
And that's actually a logical step, too, for the home energy score. It'll eventually be available on the MLS. That is, those moves are happening next year with the standardization of MLS, that the home energy score will be in the MLS under the green fields of the MLS.
So. Oh, very, very good. Yeah. Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is filled, so we should go to the phones here. Mary in Eau Claire was first up, so let's go to her. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question about the furnace fan, leaving that on. I rent a townhouse, and the landlord suggests that should be on at all times. And to me, that seems like a waste of energy to have that running all the time.
Yeah. All right. Is it six of one, half a dozen of the other? What do you think, Steve?
There's some caveats there. It depends on the actual furnace and the blower fan, on how efficient that fan will be. And for the cost side of things, if it's a newer, more efficient model, then it's going to have the ECM motor, and then there'll be some... Actually, it's more efficient to have it running full-time at a low speed. Now, if it's an older furnace and it's just got the furnace fan that runs at full blast or nothing, then maybe not so much. But there is a way around that. You can actually get a smart thermostat which Focus on Energy has an incentive for, that then you can actually program into the smart thermostat when you want that fan to come on and off. So you can have it go for 15 minutes every hour rather than having it run full time.
And what's the benefit of having a fan running all the time?
So
it keeps the, you know, it evens out the temperature in the home.
I mean,
by circulating the air. And, you know, the thing to keep in mind is there are two things the furnace is doing, whether it's heating or cooling. It's circulating air, and that's what the fan is doing. And then when the thermostat detects the need, it's either heating that air or cooling it. But it's not necessarily heating or cooling the air just because it's recirculating it.
Gotcha.
So, you know, having the fan on all the time does not mean that it's firing up and heating the air. That will be controlled by your thermostat. So they're really two separate things.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks very much, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Oregon has a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. I've got where my the sides of my house meet the foundation. I've got the studs right there, the wood that comes down into the cement. And when we purchased the building, it had there's insulation in all of those slots. And I would like to cover them with something just to prevent access to the insulation and also to see where mice are moving through my house. And also, because my primary reason is just to prevent my cats from pulling it out. We do have occasional mice in this house. We're in the country, and I'm always looking for their ways they're coming in and out and ways they're moving, but the cats pull the insulation out. What the core question is, I've got red roofing paper, I've got tight screen, I've got a few different things I could possibly cover this with. Part of my goal is to just make it, I'd like to prevent shedding of the insulation into the basement area also, but will I do any damage to the air movement through the house by covering these with certain materials? Well, I mean, I don't want to use plastic.
This is a great question, Bill, and thanks for calling in. So it sounds like you've got fiberglass batting up in those. Yeah. So, you know, the bad news is that that fiberglass batting really isn't doing anything up in that cavity. It would only be working well if it were in a sealed cavity. And because it's exposed in the basement, it's not in a sealed cavity. So if there are any air leaks around the where the wood meets the cement or the siding meets the wood, that air is just getting filtered through that fiberglass. And just like your furnace filter, it may be taking some contaminants out of the air, but it's not contributing to comfort in your home. So my recommendation would be, rather than putting a lot of effort into protecting this product that isn't doing much, what we often do, or our homeowners do, is remove that fiberglass and replace it with a rigid product. So the easiest do-it-yourselfer approach would be to buy some rigid foam that you could cut to size and then caulk into place up in those cavities. And what that will do is that will actually provide you with some thermal performance, because the rigid foam, once sealed into that cavity, will actually insulate, unlike the current loosely placed fiberglass. And by sealing up those cavities, you'll be eliminating the heat that's escaping and attracting mice. And you'll also be preventing your cats and other animals from having something to be able to easily remove, because they really can't do anything to that foam. And I'm talking about, you know, the blue or pink styrofoam. It's a rigid foam that you can purchase at the lumberyard. There's also a yellow foam board that is often faced with a metallic facing a Celotex board that you can also use in that application. But these, you know, these can be placed up there. They can do a better job of insulating and air sealing, and then you don't have to worry about your pets.
Just to follow up, what about a foam insulation up there, one of these expanding? Well, does that work or does it not? Would it not be?
Well, it can. And in fact, often when we have our insulation contractor coming in to do this, they will apply what's called a two-part foam. You know, a lot for homeowners, often the only thing that a homeowner can easily obtain is a single part foam, which is like the great stuff that you get in the can. That material does not easily stick to the surface, and so it's okay for filling a hole in the house or, you know, gaps around something. But when you're trying to apply foam to a surface and have it stick, you need the two-part foam.
There we go.
So,
taking a look at a lot of things, home improvement things today, and talking about your home's energy score with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Steve Pepson, home performance evaluator and the Focus on Energy home energy score outreach and technical advisor. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll be taking your questions about fall cleanup and how to overwinter your plants and trees and shrubs. So I hope you'll join us for that at 11. Right now, talking home improvement and your home's energy score and your home's performance in terms of energy with our two guests, Steve Pepson of the Focus on Energy program, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And let's take another call. Ken in Mayville, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Howdy. I got a couple questions. Just one, I'm curious about why do they put the heating vents underneath the windows in construction? Does it have a purpose? Because to me, it just seems like it goes up the drapes and out the windows.
Go ahead, Steve Pepson.
Yeah, can they? That is actually something that we've learned over a long period of time, that to actually get the heat to the outside walls is beneficial, because what you're doing is essentially putting a curtain of heat on those outside walls. And that's where our major heat loss is. So that's why we always direct the heat to those outside walls first. If you have the heat coming up on an inside wall, then on the other side of the room beside the outside wall is where it's the coldest.
Okay. Wow. Now, next question. Regarding a hot water heater, we recently replaced a hot water heater, put in a gas hot water heater a couple of years ago. We do run a water softener with it. But it just seems over the last months or so, the water pressure through the hot water is way lower than the water pressure when just using the cold water. And it never had an issue like that. I was just wondering, is there a way of cleaning out a hot water heater? Is that a possibility that it's gotten loaded up with some crud somehow, or?
Yeah,
that's a great question. Have you made any changes to the plumbing system? Has a new faucet been installed or anything like that?
No, I haven't done anything different. And, you know, it's not like we're doing the laundry or anything at the time. I'd have been really kind of watching it.
Has the pressure dropped at every faucet?
It does seem to be, yeah.
Okay. I mean, there could be something in the line somewhere that is contributing to that. I mean, it's also true that, you know, if there were a period in time when the water softener were not being, you know, kept in good working condition and you weren't adding salt and things, that a lot of hard water is running through the system, and we will see that, you know, pipes will get calcified, similar to, you know, the hardening of arteries in in our bodies. I mean, it constricts the flow. And so, but I mean, if you notice the difference, like that sort of a change is gradual over many years. And if it's all of a sudden something that you notice, what sometimes can happen is something in a contaminant in the pipe can break loose from the side and then, you know, end up somewhere where it's constricting the flow. It gets stuck at a fitting or something. And so then the flow has been constricted and the water pressure is not great enough to bust it out. And sometimes we see this when we're remodeling, you know, you're changing pipes and things, and something gets into the system and it ends up clogging the flow, and we end up having to, you know, drain the system, and then that will often take care of it. So I might recommend that you just shut off the water and, you know, go down to the lowest level and open up the faucet and let all the water fall out of the system, and then bring it up again and see if that doesn't maybe allow this thing to, you know, get out of the pipes. And then if that doesn't work, you might have to call the plumber.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, there's a reason for salt.
Yes.
There, sometimes people, I've been asked that question. Why do we have to have that salt? Why right. do I have to add that salt?
Yeah.
Well, that's reason why,
that's
right
correct.
There. Dean in Madison, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I got a question for you about insulation. I'm doing an addition. We're putting a second level above my 2.5-car garage.
Okay.
It'll be a new floor system with engineered floor joists. So I'm wondering about how I insulate that. And then on the second floor, we're using a scissor truss roof system with, so at the soffit end, it'll be 5 inches. And then at the top, it'll be 14. So do I fill that up solid to block all of air movement, or do I want to keep airflow through that?
Steve, do you want to start?
Starting at the floor, you're going to hopefully pack that floor full of insulation.
Fiberglass batting?
Fiberglass batting won't fill the entire cavity. I mean, there's a fiberglass bat in there. It's usually in there somewhat loosely. We usually recommend for a floor cavity, if you've got limited amount of space, to try and maximize, especially over the top of a garage, you want to maximize that insulation there. So I would probably want to recommend to go towards like a cellulose or a blow-in product. You can really dense pack that cavity. As far as the scissor truss goes up on the top side, 5 inches is not a lot of insulation. And yes, you do need to keep airflow over the top of that insulation. And what you want to try and avoid is having any airflow through the insulation.
Right. Well, the 5 inches will just be at the soffit end. And then as you go to the peak, obviously, it's 412 on the top and 212 on the inside. So
right.
that air gap is getting wider as you get towards the peak of the roof.
You know, you could go with a situation, I mean, without seeing it, but I would say, with, like, you could go with a combination of a spray foam and then go to a loose fill product. So you go with your spray foam, so you get your maximized R value up to a point when you can just stop that, because then obviously you want to keep that cost down to as minimum as possible. Mm-hmm. And then from that point, go with the open blow product, so whether it's fiberglass or cellulose.
Yeah, I would.
So you're saying to pack it full then?
Correct. Down at the bottom, you want to pack it, but I would be a little wary of going with, like, packing cellulose, and you can't pack fiberglass, so
yeah.
I'd be a little wary of packing the cellulose down there, because I don't think you're going to get your hour value that you really need.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you, do you have a contractor that's doing it, or you?
We're just getting going on it, so I'm looking for opinions. We have conflicting opinions on how to do this.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to have any condensation up in that small gap up there, so that's my question. I don't know whether I should pack it full and restrict all airflow, or to maintain airflow.
Well, I mean, one option that you do have, and I agree with Steve 100%, that down at that 5-inch heel area along the edge, you know, you almost have to use foam to get the R value you need. And if you were to just use a traditional cellulose or fiberglass, you're probably going to lose enough heat that you're going to see, you know, some ice damming and things going on the perimeter.
Sure.
You really shouldn't have that with a new structure. So you could go to what's called a hot roof, where you literally are foaming right onto the roof deck from the inside. And so rather than insulating on the interior surface where, you know, the other side of the drywall, you're putting the insulation up to the roof deck. And, you know, that would be spraying on a two-part foam. It's going to cost a little more, but it's going to give you a much more comfortable, complete package for insulation. And that way you're not actually ventilating the space. You are making the entire shell from the roof in part of that thermal envelope. But that foam product is a closed cell product that I'm recommending. And the closed cell product is a vapor barrier. So you're not going to have condensation issues, but that's a more expensive approach. Mm-hmm. But you know, you'll reap the benefits of that. You should in a more, you know, a longer lasting and more comfortable space.
Okay, so now on that hip end of that scissor truck, what would be your minimum? I think it's 5 inches, but say it was 8 or 7 or 9. At what measurement would you be comfortable with just doing a spray foam your traditional way on the inside?
Well, the spray,
five, you say, is too little.
Well, the spray foam, you'll meet the requirement for the energy code at 5 inches on the roof and 3 inches.
I'm saying on the inside gap of that scissor truck.
Well, 3 inches on the walls, on any of the wall surfaces. So, like at the gable end of the scissor truss, you know, you can end up with 3 inches in the walls and then, you know, 5 inches on the roof deck, and you'll have, you know, something that the, you know, the city will stamp and say, yes, you're meeting the energy code, and you'll actually have a very high performing structure if that foam is properly installed.
Yeah. And Steve, you're nodding in agreement on that.
Correct. Yeah. And Chad, what would you say would be the minimum heel height if he was to make that heel taller?
Well, if you, so,
if, 12 inch?
If you, yeah, if 12 inches, if he were using traditional, right, you know, fiberglass or cellulose, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because you can have, you know, one thing that Steve's bringing up there that we should mention is that, you know, often when we're building something like this, we request what we call an energy heel on that perimeter so that the truss is designed that it does not get too thin at that soffit or, you know, where it meets the wall, so that it can be properly insulated with traditional materials.
Oh, there we go. I was thinking about my own home where we took the advice of having the foam toward the bottom and then dense packed. This is along the walls, mm-hmm, and that's worked out very well, and certainly a little cost savings there.
Right, and cellulose is a great material to dense pack. It does a wonderful job, and even for existing homes, if you're not doing a remodel or something that like that where you got the walls opened up. Yeah. Putting it into an existing homes, it's probably the best material for taking care of that.
Yeah. Well, mine's an energy. It's an Energy Star home, so it met
the criteria.
Right. The criteria.
We're going to have to get you an energy score, Larry.
I guess so. I'm going to have you guys over to do an energy score for $100. Why not?
I know someone who can take care of that.
All right, let's go to Susan in Menominee, Michigan next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I also need to insulate my soap boxes. I use my basement a lot. It's my workshop. I work down there every day. I'm wondering if I should just hire someone to spray, fill the soap boxes, and also cover the walls with spray foam.
Steve, what do you think?
Covering the walls with spray foam, that's a big job, but it is a good insulation for the basement walls. That spray foam then does need to be covered with a fire barrier. So we need to make sure that it has an ignition barrier, I think is the correct terminology. And then that can be either intumescent paint, which is a paint that's applied to it, or then you need to build a wall inside of it, then apply drywall over the top of that, and that would then satisfy the code. But that would also be somewhat more of an expensive job. You could possibly, there's other ways of going about that would be a little less expensive, and I can throw that over to Chad.
Sure. Yeah. So one thing is that the spray-on two-part foam, or any material that you put up in the sill box, which, you know, is up in the floor system or the ceiling system relative to being in the basement, but it's your floor for your main level. That you don't have to worry about the fire protection, but Steve is correct. Once you come down below that floor framing, you do have to use something to protect the walls. And so what we'll often use is the Celotex product, which is a aluminum face product that we can put on those walls, and that is a fire rated product. So it does that. That is the one foam product we can put up and not have to cover. And that's just the sheet material. So that can be applied to the walls, and then you're done. And then you just have to be careful not to poke into it because it is a reasonably soft material.
Good luck, Susan. Thanks a lot for calling. And Rod in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Say, the individual called about the Silbox foam. We had that done to our house a couple of years ago. We live on the outskirts of Madison. And I did something to make sure that it really did a good job, and that was I took a votive candle and I set it up on the sill to see if it blew the flame around, and it did. And after they completely cleaned the system out and then refoamed it, there was no air infiltration at all. It raised the temperature of our basement in the winter months by about 15 degrees.
Yeah, good.
And it really did a good job. So if somebody wants to do that, they really should get a contractor. We found a guy in Madison who did a great job.
Yeah.
My question, though, was about ceiling fans. Running them constantly in order to circulate air and reversing them summer to winter. Does that really make a difference?
You know, the thing with any fan is fans move air across your skin, so they don't intrinsically make a room warmer or cooler. It's actually that feeling of air moving across your skin creates a sort of feeling of you personally that I feel warmer or cooler. So, you know, it's really a personal preference in my mind. As for saving energy, if you have a high ceiling, of course, then it's going to help move that warm air that is sitting at the top of, up by the ceiling down towards the lower part of the room. That's always a good thing. And the reverse for the summer months. So, you know, you want to also look to your manufacturer's book for the fan to make sure you actually have it in the correct setting, because sometimes they can be a little different on reversing. So, but yeah, I think it's a good thing. But running them constant, the other thing with a fan is if you're not actually in the room, that fan's really not saving you anything, because unless you're actually sitting underneath the fan, you don't actually benefit.
What's the which is it, clockwise in the summer and counterclockwise in the winter? How's the, I can't remember how it.
You know, I mean, I just look at the blade, because if right. the blade is pushing air, you know, down, if it's going.
Oh, okay.
And it's impossible to show on the radio, of course. But if it, you know, if the blade is, as you watch it slowly, you have to put it on the slow speed to see which way it's actually going relative to the tilt of the blade. But I think, you know, most people, they look at the blade and say, oh, yeah, that's pushing air down, or it's lifting it up, pushing
right.
it
and
up.
Right, and I think the other way you can sense it is if you're standing directly below the fan and feel air moving over you, that would be pushing the air, like, in the summer mode.
Mm-hmm.
If you're feeling like you're standing under it and you're feeling the actual air coming over you, that's in the winter mode, because what it's doing is actually pushing the air to the outside of the room and pushing it down around the outside of the room.
Gotcha.
You hold a piece of tissue paper or something a few feet below the fan and see whether it's being sucked up or pushed down, and that also will indicate.
Well, Rod could use the candle again.
Yes, Rod could use the candle. That's exactly right. Thanks, Rod. Appreciate the call. Mark in Sparta, we're on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, I'm calling about a air exchanger.
Yeah.
How often do they need to run if the house is older? Or I know they're supposed to run more if they're newer. What is your recommendation on that?
Have you had you have an older home from the sound of it. Have you had that tightened up a lot?
No, we built a newer home at 7 years old.
Oh, I gotcha.
Built it. They wanted to, said I had to run it all the time. Now I'm just wondering if I can shut it down some, or if I should just leave it on auto mode, or what? So.
You know, that's a great question, and I'm not going to have the exact answer for you, but I will say that because we defer to our heating specialist on that. I mean, if you know how tight the house is really how often that fan needs to run is connected directly to how tight the house is, because the tighter the home is, the more it needs the fresh air that exchanger is providing, because those appliances, for our listeners that don't know, are designed to bring in fresh air and exhaust the stale air, but to do it in a way that doesn't simply bring in unconditioned air and dump out conditioned air, losing all of the heat that you've created or the cooler dehumidified air. So, you know, it's essentially an energy-saving device that also provides fresh air. Whereas, of course, you could just open your windows if you, you know, if the season were such that you just wanted fresh air and the temperature were fine. So, They're appliances that often do not need to be run continuously, but they should be cycling on and off so that you are constantly providing some fresh air to the home. So just, I hope that helps to answer your question. And if there is an auto mode on your control, then you might consider using that.
That's what we use. Okay, thank you.
And I would add to that, too, that's the V part of HVAC, the ventilation part. And a lot of we have a lot of contractors out there who do the H and the AC and not so much the V. But if you can find a contractor, a HVAC contractor, who can look to the ventilation side of it and maybe even get a bit of programming, because like the new thermostats now will actually handle that as well as the heating and cooling. So
there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Candace on Facebook wonders why the Focus on Energy rebate on the EcoB4 smart thermostat is not applicable to homes heated by LP.
The homes heated by LP are not part of our program, and that is because they are not part of the utilities. So you're buying your LP directly from your LP supplier. The LP supplier is not giving us funds to put into the program.
Gotcha.
So all the participating utilities do have that available to them. They put in the funds to Focus on Energy. So LP, unfortunately, folks who fall outside of our parameters, but there is, if you do, you can get some incentives for the electrical side. So that's the light bulbs, obviously, are still available to folks.
Yeah.
Also, if you're heating your hot water with electric, there is an incentive available for the new heat pump water heaters.
Oh, excellent. Steve in Cottage Grove, you're on the air. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering what your guests, for new construction, I'm wondering what your guests think of insulated concrete forms.
I think they're great. It's a great way to go. You're going to use less concrete, typically a little bit less concrete, and you're going to be providing a built-in form that you don't, that doesn't go away, that's going to help to retain that thermal mass and provide greater comfort in the construction of the building. And so, are you thinking about an entire home, the walls all the way up to the roof?
Yeah.
I mean, I've always been amazed when I go in these homes. I don't encounter them very often, but when I do, I am amazed at how comfortable these homes are. I mean, they really are. And, I have not yet seen what these houses look like if a tornado happens to blow through the neighborhood. But I'm going to guess that the roof might get torn off, but I think those walls are going to be there. So it's a great way to go, given the, certain things that are going on and the propensity for tornadoes to just materialize recently here in the Madison area, at least. We had one a block from our office a month ago.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Steve. Appreciate it. Taking a look at your home today here on the Ideas Network, your home energy score, your home performance when it comes to energy with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Steve Pipson of the Wisconsin Focus on Energy Program. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking about your home's performance today when it comes to energy with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and Steve Pipson of the Focus on Energy program. Great to have them along. You can join in one open line at 800-642-1234. And Steve, there was a free program that I know you wanted to mention relating to.
Focus on Energy has a simple energy efficiency program, which you can go to focusonenergy.com/simple. And you put in your utility account number, your address, and get to choose one of six different variations of a box, and that will come to you in the mail for free.
Oh, excellent. And provide you with some good information.
Yes, and the inside of that box can be anything from water-saving devices to LED light bulbs, Pipe wrap insulation, smart strips, which are for situations where you got a TV and all the other appliances that go around the TV. So.
Yeah. So, and again, now people are going to say, wait a minute, where was that again?
Okay, so that's focusonenergy.com/simple.
focusonenergy.com/simple. Maybe if Jill has time, we can put that up on our Facebook page as well. Let's go to John in Spring Green next. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is related to the guy called in on the attic, only mine's the crawl space. And it don't have a moisture barrier now, but I was contemplating putting in some plastic on the ground, or you guys were talking about that spray foam for an insulation. Which one would be a better choice, or both?
John, I would recommend, yes, to put in that vapor barrier on the floor of the crawl space. That is actually one of our requirements for any project coming into our program to get incentives, as there has to be the vapor barrier on the actual crawl space. For the insulation, I would highly recommend to go with that spray foam on the walls and then up into the sill box. For crawl spaces, that's a best way to go.
Put it on the floor.
On the floor, you can insulate across the floor. I have seen that done. There's not a lot of energy savings there just from putting that spray foam on the floor, but yes, it can act as the vapor barrier for the crawl space for the issues of vapor coming through.
So the first thing would probably be just put the plastic on the ground, in the crawl space, and then up on the wall, and then spray foam it on the wall.
Correct. So you would run that vapor barrier across the floor and then up the wall 12 inches or 16 inches like that, and maybe you have some silicone to seal it up against the wall, and then you would spray foam down the wall and over the top of that vapor barrier.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Dave in Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Well, I got to start by telling you that Jill is just too perky.
Jill is too perky. All right.
The other one is, he made a glaring mistake earlier when he said about turning off your fan in the summertime. Yes, but in the wintertime, I live in a straw bale house, and I heat with an unvented gas fireplace. And if I turn the fan off, and I do, I aim it up so that the air goes up and comes down the walls, which spreads the heat really nice in the place. But also, the fireplace comes on half as much. Because if I have the fan off, it's almost 100 degrees up at the top of the ceiling and maybe 50 degrees down by the floor.
Yeah.
So leaving the fan on all the time in the winter, I would never think of turning it off, because the fan costs about $3 a month to rent, and my gas bill would double if I turned the fan off.
Uh-huh.
So this is you've got a stove or fireplace that's a single-point heat source, correct?
Right, but I've only got a 1,000-square-foot house.
Right.
But that heat, doesn't matter what size your house is, the heat's always going to cling up by the ceiling, where I'm not spending any time up there myself.
sure, though. I mean, most of us don't have cathedral ceilings and the heat is coming in through multiple points in the system, whether it's radiators or heat ducts. And so your point is an excellent point. Not every home is, they're not all the same. And so I think what I would say is probably in your situation, there's a reason.
Reason. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Dave. Appreciate it. Matt in Beechwood, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Morning.
I'm remodeling an old brick farmhouse. And I know, there's that air gap between the brick and the wall, the wood wall. And this is that, what do they call that, where the studs go all the way up, the old style construction.
Balloon framing.
Right, right. Now, I just was listening, and you were talking about those sill where the guy was putting foam, up there to get the draft down. I was just thinking about it. Could you put rigid insulation up against that, they have like some kind of tar paper, you know, between the wall, the studs, and the outer wood wall, you know, but that still doesn't stop any kind of drafts. So I was curious if I could put like that insulation against the wood and then say fiberglass against that, or would it be better off just having like somebody come in and roll that or the spray foam?
Are you talking about inside the frame structure?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
So it is true that if you put a layer of foam up first and then something like fiberglass after that, that can have value because the foam has sealed up all the little nooks and crannies.
And you should like caulk it.
That's true. Caulking can be done right. as well. And though there, you still have the issue that if the fiberglass is just sitting there, you know, kind of in that space, it's not necessarily doing much additionally. Whereas if it's within a wall assembly and it's a well-sealed assembly, the fiberglass does provide some heat resistance. So, I think that answers your question. I do want, though, to address, you were referring to the brick on the exterior and how there's a gap between the brick and the framed wall. And right. so that is by design because a masonry wall, you know, water will go through that wall. And it's actually true that any building, that no matter what the exterior cladding is, we always assume that water is going to get through that. And it literally goes right through brick, but it will go through the weep holes of vinyl, and it'll get through little nooks and crannies on a cedar home. And so there has to be a space back there for water to be able to be stopped and then drain out. We call it a drain plane. And the old tar paper is the older material that we used, and then, you know, Tyvek and other materials have been used more recently. But it's important to have by design a space for the water to be able to get out.
All right. So,
one thing I'd actually add to that, Chad, too, is if you're putting that fiberglass in the cavity with that extra spray foam, is to make sure that your fiberglass is not compressed, because fiberglass does not work as well for its R value. Is not as high if the actual material is compressed. It needs to be sort of in a fluffy, like it is when it comes out of the bag.
There we go. Thank you very much, Matt. Bob in Forest Lake, Minnesota, your turn.
Hey, guys. Thanks for that last little bit. Did not know about the fiberglass being compressed. Wish I'd have known that 5 days ago. Got a little bit of remodeling to do. Anyways, I have an existing house that has 3 bedrooms. I'm looking to put more equity into it by putting in maybe 1 or 2 more bedrooms. I have a part of my house that has a full basement and then another part that has a crawl space. Would it be better for me to go under or on top?
Of the crawl space?
Yeah, would it make sense for me to take that crawl space, turn it into a full basement, or would it be better for me to build on top?
Well, that's a great question. So a couple of things. I mean, it is typically fairly expensive and, you know, difficult to go significantly lower within an existing foundation system. So, for example, I mean, we've looked at doing this for a couple of our clients over the years. And when you have a footing at a certain elevation and you want to go lower than that footing, which is what often has to happen when you go lower under a crawl space, you've got to put a buttress wall on the entire perimeter. So you're essentially coming in however many feet as you're going down. So if you want to go down 2 feet, you've got to come in 2 feet. It's a 1-to-1 ratio. So if you want to go down 3 feet, you're going to lose 3 feet on the entire perimeter. So that's likely to be fairly costly relative to the complete additional value that you'll have if you add the space up top, which I think is your question, you know, whether to go up or go down. And so, you know, the caveat is that generally if you have a lower level that you want to finish, it's less expensive to finish off that lower level if it can be turned into living space. I mean, obviously, a crawl space is not a candidate, but a lower level basement might be a candidate for finishing and making it a comfortable, habitable space if you've got 7 feet or more of headroom. And that's going to be less expensive to renovate than adding an outright addition. But I think you'll find that going down in the crawl space area is just as expensive as going up. And at the end of the day, space above grade is more valuable than space below grade.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting with Chad Spate of Chad's Design Build and Steve Pepson of the Focus on Energy program. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at home energy today with our two guests, Chad Spate of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Steve Pepson, Home Performance Evaluator in the Focus on Energy program. It's great to have both of them here. And we'll take your questions and comments. Number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Roberta emailed to ask, is there any special pricing for energy audit for seniors on a fixed income? Also, is there a rebate for adding insulation in an attic for someone with low income?
So, Larry, we do have a program that is designed. Well, it's actually, we have two tiers to our home improvements program, and one tier is for all customers who are participating utilities. The other one is for folks who are on a certain income bracket. They can go onto our website at focusonenergy.com and check out to see where they're at with that. If they're in that bracket, in that income bracket, then they can apply. And then that does bring down the cost of that energy assessment to, I believe it's $50.
Okay, well, that's good.
And that's a pretty good deal. So, and then there is an higher incentive available to folks who fall into that income bracket. And now that it is income, not assets. So for someone who is retired, it won't look at their assets. Like if they own their home outright, it doesn't look at that. It's actually about the income that they're earning. So,
okay, very good. Thanks for that question, Roberta. Tom in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hey. Hi, Larry. Thanks for another great show.
Thank you.
I bought a house a little while ago, and the second floor has a peaked ceiling in the bedroom, and there's a little fan up there, a ceiling fan, and it doesn't seem to matter whether you have it blowing down or sucking up towards the ceiling. There's just not a lot of airflow, and I'm wondering if there is enough airspace on top of the blade for the fan to work effectively.
Oh, so is there enough room between the roof, the ceiling, and the fan? How many inches do you need?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm not sure really what the scientific answer to that would be. I mean, I would say that there is, I'm sure, a relationship between that space for it really to function well.
Yeah, and with it being a slope ceiling as well and not being a flat ceiling, it's not being able to push the air around as easily as it would on a flat ceiling. So there might be some dynamics going on there.
Right? Would you, I'm trying to think, would it be better to have a longer arm down for a peak?
That could be a way of solving it, is actually putting the extension rod on the fan itself to get that fan down lower, so the fan is maybe around at the 8-foot mark or somewhere around there.
It'd be worth it. At least it's not all that, it wouldn't be all that expensive to add that part and just try.
You may be looking at a new fan because the fan that is there may not be able to be adapted. Some can, some cannot. So
yeah,
thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Jane in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a question about a crawl space situation. We bought a house built in the 70s. About 10 years later, they put a 9-foot addition on the back of the house, all the way across the back of the house. So it's about 9 by 40. And they built that on a crawl space. They didn't put full basement under there. It's a poured basement, and the walls around the outside of the crawl space are poured. But the floor is dirt. They did not put a floor surface in there at all, and there's no plastic or any kind of vapor barrier on there. The only opening to this crawl space is where they left the opening where the little narrow basement window was.
Yeah.
And through that opening, they ran a heat duct, which then splits into two registers. So, you know, one is in each room at the back of the house. These rooms at the back of the house are not separate rooms. They opened it to make a much larger living room and kitchen. And I've always been uncomfortable about that dirt, you know, sand floor in there. My husband said he can kind of see in there. You know, you get up to that little window, you shine a flashlight down, it drops about 3 more feet. And he said it just seems just absolutely dry as a bone in there. But there really isn't access to do something else. We worried a little about radon. We did a radon test in the basement, and it was acceptable. And the only thing I could think of is that we would have to actually cut out a larger opening, cut it in the basement wall to get down so you could take materials or a person could get in there. Do you have any other ideas on how we could seal off that floor, like shooting something through that opening or something?
Well, this is a great question, and I'll confess I've seen situations like this a few times, so it's not that unusual. It is true that you have two choices, really. I mean, one choice is that the ductwork could be temporarily dismantled to allow for access into that space. And, I mean, that's going to require a heating contractor that, you know, is willing to do that. But that might end up, depending on the other variables, being a more cost-effective approach. The other, though, that you've already mentioned is just making a larger opening into that space. That's what we have done on a few occasions for clients when we're trying to address issues of concern. I want to commend you for having looked into the radon problem. That was my number one concern as you were explaining what you were dealing with. And if you don't have radon, then you're lucky, and that has not been contaminating the air you breathe in the home. And even though it may appear dry, you know, a humidistat will indicate how much humidity might be coming out of that space. But chances are pretty good when the conditions are right that moisture from the ground is being sucked into the home, and it will be a lot easier for that to happen given that you have the open floor. To make the improvement of being able to go in there, to access it, to properly put in a vapor barrier and then do some insulating, I think you're going to have to cut a bigger hole in the foundation wall that connects the two spaces. But like I say, if you can find someone willing to dismantle that ductwork, that might be a path that allows it to be a little less expensive. The caveat there is that, you know, it's hard to get into that opening, and some of the insulation contractor may demand a larger opening, even if the ductwork were removed. So it's something you'll want to coordinate.
Yeah, or you need to get hire my daughter, who is as skinny as a rail, to get through that window. That's the other one. she could probably get through it.
Yes,
Jane, yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's turn. We've got a Facebook photo from Justin. He purchased his first home last month. It has a boiler. He doesn't know much about them. He just posted a photo of the boiler. It seems to run all the time, and he wonders if that's normal. We're taking a look at the photo right now on Visitor Post.
I would say that a boiler running constantly, nonstop, is probably not right. There's something wrong. Exactly what it is, really hard to pinpoint, and you'd want to get an expert involved, a HVAC contractor who has a specialty in boilers to come and take a look at it.
Yeah,
I would agree.
Fran in Stone Lake, we turn to you next. Hi, Fran.
Hi.
What can we
Thanks
do for you?
Thanks for taking
my
call. Well, we just, we about 3 years ago remodeled a cabin, and it was totally re-insulated with spray foam in the ceiling and in the walls, and we had an air exchanger installed, and because our windows were getting so full of condensation, I'm wondering what the optimum humidity should be in the house. We have a humidistat that registers the temperature outside and the temperature inside and the humidity. And for, you know, health reasons and for the to keep the air circulating fresh and so forth, what should the humidity be in a closed home in the winter?
Fran, I would say that the humidity should be, I would start at around 35%. I've heard from HVAC contractors 35 to 45, and then I've heard from other experts going on the lower end, 35 down to 25. So happy middle is 35, so that would be somewhere I'd want to start. You also may want to take a look around your house and see where your moisture sources are. I mean, are they in full control? I mean, do you have a lot of potted plants? Do you have a fish tank? All of these things can add to the humidity level in the house, so there's no point having the air exchanger running constantly to try and keep up with the humidity level if you can actually decrease the humidity in the house from the sources.
I see. What about the percentage on the air exchanger? What should that be at? We manually adjust it, and would that be 50% to get it at 30% humidity in the house?
That I'm stepping beyond my knowledge base on that one, and I would probably want to venture towards having you check in with an expert, a HVAC contractor, who can give you the right advice on that.
You could probably, I wonder if you know the company, the name of the company, you might be able to go to their website and check that way too.
I think we've done that, so I think we can kind of play around with those percentages and try and do, you know, the plant thing and the fish tank thing are good suggestions.
Do you have a little hygrometer that, you know, you can buy very inexpensive hygrometers at the hardware store? You know, they're $10-$15, and you just, you know, you can put them around the house, and that way you can monitor the relative humidity and then learn where you need to put the dial to get the humidity at the level that feels right and is recording.
Right. That would be a good idea.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
And a fan? Would a fan help to circulate some of the air, too? That would help?
No, because the fan is just circulating the humid air. If it is hot, too high on the humidity side, then all your fan is doing is just circulating that same air. So.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll try that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Joe in Eau Claire. On to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Thanks.
Appreciate the call.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question about my home. My wife and I bought it about 13 years ago, and it's an old farm home. We had an energy audit shortly after we bought it, and basically they just told us, you know, your house is full of moving air. You know, it had no insulation whatsoever in it. Anyway, we replaced our windows, and that's when I kind of determined, yep, we definitely have no insulation at all. So this fall, I took the initiative to knock out all the drywall. It wasn't even drywall. It's like this wood fiber stuff. I guess that's the way they did things back then for insulation. But I took it out, and all the cavities were hollow, and this is in my living room. Anyway, I put in 3 inches of rigid pink foam, and I glued it to the backing, and I screwed it in, and then I used expansion foam all the way around, and it sealed it off really well, and put drywall back up. And our living room is finally warm, you know, now that things are getting cool. So my question is, you know, I did this myself. Is there any kind of rebate for a guy like me who, you know, just goes in and adds insulation?
All right.
Unfortunately, Joe, the only rebate is going to be a pat on the back for doing the right thing. Unfortunately for us, for our program, you have to use a participating trade ally, and that's the only way that you can get the incentive. The incentive is an instant discount. That trade ally has to do the applying for the incentive for you. So You did a good job on that insulation. I have to commend you on that. So you did a great job there. But unfortunately, there's no incentive. And we do for you in that instance. But we do find sometimes folks jump a little too far ahead, like in pulling out that drywall or the inside of their home, and then find out about the incentives. And at that point, we even have we struggled to get that blower door to have a correct number because we've already taken off the inside barrier. So we really need to have that blower door number prior to any work starting. So we want to get that accurate number so that then we can have an accurate number after the work's completed.
Too late for Joe, but
I did have that audit, and that number somewhere is on record.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you said 13 years was about the time frame when you had it.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, we require them to be about no more than 2 years old when we're looking at those numbers because we never know what's happened to the house in that interim.
Yeah. All right, so you've provided a good service, Joe, for other folks who are thinking about doing this work. Thank you so much for calling. And you know what? You saved yourself a bunch of money to begin with by doing the work, and so you can take some satisfaction in that, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Chris in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I want to go back to the earlier question, the space between the foundation of the house and the house itself, and you said to caulk in rigid foam. Do you need to cover that with drywall then as a fire retardant?
Not if it's up in the above the foundation wall, essentially in the primary floor system, which we call the ring joist. You know, that area, the sill, is an area where you don't have to worry about that. But once you come down onto the foundation wall below that framing system, then we have to be worried about fire protection.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for calling. Deb in Menominee Falls, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering, we have an established home that we've been working on trying to make more energy efficient through the years. We just finished up this summer on replacing the last round of windows, so we have all new energy-efficient windows. So we're looking at insulation now. And I'm wondering if you contract somebody who does insulation, do they automatically check the ventilation as well?
Deb, I mean, I would recommend the first place to start, if you're just starting on the path for insulation, is going to our website and finding someone who can do an energy assessment on your home. When the consultant goes up into the attic, they can certainly go over and check the soffits to make sure that they are venting correctly. Sometimes we do find that like material has fallen down into those soffit areas and it's covered over the vents. So that can be part of the process. It's not always necessarily part of the inspection that we're doing, but it certainly can be if that is a concern. You can bring that up to the consultant, and they can certainly check it while they're in the attic.
And then once that energy audit and a blower door test, then she might be prime for some rebates.
Correct. And if not, if the incentives aren't available, at least you'll know your path to doing the insulation and which part of the house should be first, which part should be second and such.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. So go to focusonenergy.com.
Yep. And on there, right on our landing page on focusonenergy.com, we have a zip code search. So you can go up there and search for a contractor or an HVAC contractor or trade LA, as we call them. If you search in the Madison area, you'll find Chad will be listed up there as one of our trade allies.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Aaron in Sun Prairie next. Aaron, hi. Thanks.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I have a ranch home with a completely finished basement. And luckily, 10-foot ceilings in that basement. But since having a furnace replaced about 2 years ago, I've noticed there's not much air turning over downstairs. I'm guessing the new furnace is sealed better, and the ductwork that they did have to replace when they did the installs probably better done than it was originally. There are no cold air returns anywhere in my finished basement, and So I've noticed in summer, it's considerably cooler down there and even gets a bit musty smelling. I'm wondering whether or not I should consider trying to add a cold air return on that lower level to better get the air rolling over in the house.
Great question. The answer is definitely. You know, the furnace will be able to just do a better job year round when or whenever you're dehumidifying, which is what an air conditioner does, or when you're heating it. Having that return will create the airflow that allows us to, you know, make a difference. So, I think that might help to deal with your humidity problems in the warmer months, but I'll also add that it's not unusual to have to invest in dehumidification beyond the primary air conditioning system in the home, because lower levels, if the, you know, depending on how the house was built, if that humidity is driving in, and it often does, then the simple act of dehumidifying the air will lead more moisture to come into the space. It's just physics. So, you know, if there isn't a vapor barrier on the outside of the walls and underneath the floor, then that moisture is going to come in. And so if that persists, what I would, you know, I would try the return first, but then if that doesn't really solve the problem, it's still a good thing to do. And then I would look at putting in a high-efficiency dehumidification system. There's a company actually out of Madison that makes, I believe they call it the Sierra system.
Santa Fe,
yeah, thank you. And that is an excellent system. It is a high-efficiency dehumidifier, so it's going to be more expensive to purchase it and have it installed. But then it will be much less costly to operate it, and it will do a much better job of taking gallons of water out of your air and improving your home.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And should we replace our carbon monoxide detectors every few years?
No. The batteries, yes.
The batteries, yes. All right. Thanks very much, Chad and Steve, for being with us today. Chad Spate owns Chad's Design Build in Madison. Steve Pipson, home performance evaluator with the Focus on Energy program. Great show. I really appreciated having these guys with us, and thank you for your calls. Tomorrow, Garden Talk, we'll be talking about fall cleanup and how to overwinter your plants. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.